Time to go.
Students of Hitler's Table Talk Study Hour, live on Carolyn Jaeger Uncensored, me every Thursday evening, live on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Carolyn.
And I'm Ray.
We're your hosts, and today's date is July 10th, 2014. And I think every once in a while I should add this, that the section of the book we'll be reading is from January 5th to January 9th, 1942, and that Hitler's Table Talk is a record of dinner table conversation by the German leader from 1941 to 1944, actually during the war years, as it was taken down by a trusted aide, attorney Heinrich Heim, and Heim immediately typed up in full sentences his shorthand notes following the end of the after-meal talk. Then Martin Bormann, who was also present, checked it over for accuracy and locked the pages up in the big safe in his office there. So sometimes I think I just jump into it and I just assume that everybody listening knows all about Hitler's Table Talk and what it means and where it comes from. And they probably don't, so it's good to repeat it every so often, huh? So are you ready to begin reading, Ray? Or do you have any preliminary comments?
I am ready for this.
All right.
All right, we're going to start on the night of 4th and 5th January 1942 with a special guest, Sepp Dietrich.
Yeah, and we talked about Sepp Dietrich quite a bit last week.
Right.
So I hope people remember about that. But, you know, I was reading up on him afterwards, and we mentioned that he was a loyal party member, and he functioned within the party, did a lot of things for Hitler, but then he became a Waffen-SS officer, and he ended up being a general, and he did quite a bit of fighting, leading troops on the front, and he even towards the end criticized Hitler, and because he was so close to Hitler, he could get away with it, and he criticized Hitler for his handling of some of those things. Now, you know, it led me to think that some of this criticism of Hitler is not really all due to Hitler's bad decisions, but it's due to treason that was taking place, which couldn't be always seen ahead of time what was going to happen in that. But in any case, that there's quite a bit of a story to Sepp Dietrich.
Exactly.
Yeah, but a good National Socialist. Well,
absolutely. A military hero and a guy who was very, very strong in his convictions and stuck by him, and that's one of the reasons why Hitler admired him as much as he did.
Yeah. Well, he was loyal, yes. And that's
exactly
why he could make his criticism. He meant it for the best.
That's right.
So, all right, get started then.
All right. The Führer says, "The Jews didn't believe the new Europe would be born. They could never settle themselves in Japan. They've always mistrusted this world wrapped up in itself. They've always seen in it a powerful danger to themselves. And that's why they've constantly striven to keep England and America away from Japan. Just as there have always been two Germanies, so there have always been two Japans. The one, capitalist and therefore Anglophile. The other, the Japan of the rising sun, the land of the samurai. The Japanese Navy is the expression of this second world. It's amongst the sailors that we found the men nearest to ourselves. Oshima, for example, what a magnificent head he has. On the other hand, certain men belonging to the Mikado's entourage have given me an impression of decadence. Throughout a period of 2,600 years, Japan never had a war on her soil. One thing for which one must be grateful to Ribbentrop is having understood the full significance of our pact with Japan and drawn the conclusions from it with great lucidity. Our Navy was inspired by the same state of mind, but the Army would have preferred an alliance with China. I'm very glad I recently said all I think about Roosevelt. There's no doubt about it, he's a sick brain. The noise he made at his press conference was typically Hebraic. There's nobody stupider than the Americans. What a humiliation for them. The further they fall, the greater their disillusionment. In any case, neither of the two Anglo-Saxons is any better than the other. One can scarcely see how they could find fault with one another. Churchill and Roosevelt, what imposters. One can expect utterly extravagant repercussions. In the secrecy of their hearts, the South Americans loathe the Yankees. I don't believe the Americans are attacking the Azores. They've let the moment go by. From this moment, the Dutch, whether they like it or not, are bound up with our fortunes. Zeisler told me today that the Italian regiment of tanks has made a very incisive counterattack. To troops, the Spaniards are a crew of ragamuffins. They regard a rifle as an instrument that should not be cleaned under any pretext. Their sentries exist only in principle. They don't take up their posts, or if they do take them up, they do so in their sleep. When the Russians arrive, the natives have to wake them up. But the Spaniards have never yielded an inch of ground. One can't imagine more fearless fellows. They scarcely take cover. They flout death. I know, in any case, that our men are always glad to have Spaniards as neighbors in their sector. If one reads the writing of Gobin on the Spaniards, one realizes that nothing has changed in 100 years. Extraordinarily brave, tough against privations, but wildly undisciplined. What is lamentable with them is the difference in treatment between officers and men. The Spanish officers live in clover, and the men are reduced to the most meager pittance. The Hungarians are good auxiliaries for us. With proper stiffening, we find them very useful. As for Romania, she has only one man, Antonescu.
Well, he jumps around a bit in that section. I hope people were able to follow it. I like what he said about the Spanish. He's probably exactly right, and he points out that they're brave men, but also that you can't they don't always do what they're supposed to do, maybe, or but
right, undisciplined, but valiant fighters.
Yeah. He speaks about Oshima. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand. Well, let me start out in the beginning there. I didn't understand what he's saying about the Jews in Japan. I wasn't really clear, but I'm trying to figure it out. And I looked up things, but I never did come clear on this. They're saying that they've always seen in Japan a powerful danger to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so they've striven to keep England and America away from Japan.
Yes.
But I don't know what he's going on with that.
Well, you know, Carolyn, that's an excellent point. And when I read that, I just have to go with how it struck me. And what you have here in Japan is a very closed society and very racially unified. Mm-hmm. And that's the last thing that the Jews want for any country is one that can be nationalist and racially unified instead of diverse. And when he saw Japan as a society like that, then it was definitely a threat to the Jews because they could not overcome it, divide it, take it over because they were one people.
Yeah, so that's why I think you're exactly right. That's why he's saying they wanted to keep England and America away from Japan.
So they wouldn't be influenced
at all or see it as any kind of anything to admire.
That's right.
The way the Japanese were, that they were so close.
And that's just the way I took it. So.
Well, you're right. I don't know why he didn't see that as simply as that. Okay, and then he... now this Oshima, we weren't exactly sure what his position was last week, but Hitler certainly speaks well of him again.
Exactly.
And in 1934 he became the Japanese military attaché in Berlin, and I read that he spoke almost perfect German, and he was soon befriended by von Ribbentrop, and he was really admired the Germans, and he was 100%. National Socialist, fan or whatever, from the beginning, and he loved the Nazis, I guess you could say, and he was agreed with everything they did, and he was appointed as ambassador to Berlin in 1938. I think it was partly because Joachim von Ribbentrop and Hitler both liked him so much, and he had. Good access to Hitler and Ribbentrop, too. He had a lot of access to Hitler. He was kind of a Hitler favorite. I guess I'll just leave it at that.
Well, what I think that Oshima represented was exactly what Hitler said early on in this little paragraph about Japan. There are two Japans. One of them is the capitalist, the other the samurai. And obviously which one was most admirable by National Socialist Germany, and Oshima had to have belonged to the samurai philosophy. And he said that's among the people that we found nearest to ourselves.
Right. And another thing, Oshima, he was a military officer. He had been in he had served, you know, as a on the fighting and so on. He wasn't just a diplomat. He was a military man, and then they made him the military attaché in Berlin in 34 after he had, you know, carried out quite a few, positions in, and he kept getting promotions, military promotions. So he ended up, he was a lieutenant colonel or something like that, and then they made him ambassador. So he wasn't doing any fighting at that time, but he had done it.
Right. And then going on further than that little paragraph there was one thing I was going to ask your comment on here, because it's kind of simple, but I thought, well, where he says he really appreciated, was grateful to Ribbentrop for understanding the full significance of our pact with Japan. He says, our Navy was inspired by the same state of mind, but the Army would have preferred an alliance with China. That's interesting to me because, of course, Japan and China were at each other's throats at the time. China was divided between Mao and Chiang Kai-shek fighting each other. But when he says our Army would have preferred an alliance with China, to me that meant, well... naturally, being a foot soldier in an army, you would prefer an alliance with the country that has the most in soldiers, the high numbers of Chinese soldiers, and you wouldn't want to go against them, and you'd prefer to be allied with the Chinese rather than the Japanese, simply because you're a ground force member. I just thought it was a unique comment.
Well, you know what? When I was reading about Oshima, I wanted to read about the pact with Japan, because I wasn't at all clear about how Germany and Japan got their alliance going. And I was reading all of that. I didn't take any notes, but as I recall, it's very pertinent to what you're asking here, that when... that other guy named Kono came and visited Germany in the 30s, early 30s, like, and mid 30s maybe, and he was interested in coming up with some agreements, arrangements with Germany, and somehow Ribbentrop got in on that, and he thought that was good too. And then Hitler did, and eventually they worked out this. They hadn't signed it yet. They worked out this first alliance that they had between Germany and Japan, and it said there that that in both countries, some of the people were highly opposed to it, and some were very very for it. And like both cases, it was the super nationalists who were for it, and the others who were not, who hadn't come to that point yet. And in Germany, it did mention that the army preferred an alliance with China because, well, it said that a lot of, and also the Foreign Office, not Ribbentrop. Ribbentrop was functioning as a kind of a favorite of Hitler's before he became head of the Foreign Office, and the current head of the Foreign Office, then, as I recall it, the Foreign Office didn't wanted an alliance with China too, or didn't want to upset China. And then in Japan, they didn't want to upset the English, except for these super nationalists in Japan. They wanted to go with Germany. And in the end, they did sign the thing. But And they said that in Germany, a lot of the people didn't want to go with Japan because they had a lot of financial arrangements in China. I don't know if those were, as I'm trying to recall, you know, market things or investment kind of stuff. But they had been kind of moving along with China, and they didn't want to damage any of that.
Sure.
But then after that alliance with Japan and Germany, then Mussolini wanted to get in on it. Yeah. And he was looking, and then he asked Japan to sign an agreement with Italy. And then other things happened, and finally they had their tripartite pact later on between the three of them.
Right.
But, it wasn't... there were big factions that were against that.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I wanted to comment on something in the next paragraph as well. Back in the early 90s... I happened to be fortunate enough to make the association of a very, very educated gentleman from the Middle East, widely traveled, and we had occasion to converse quite often about history, politics, and things like this. And I'll never forget one day he told me we're driving along. I was taking him to Austin, and we're talking about history and politics, and particularly World War II and the aftermath, and he said, you know, he said about Americans, I have traveled and talked with many people in many places, and he said, Americans are dumb. And then he was afraid that he had offended me. And he said, well, you know, I said, I am in thorough agreement with you. He said, they're the most misinformed people on the face of the earth. Despite what they're supposed to have this great communication system and everything. Well, I said, you know, you're exactly right. And here it was mentioned by Hitler where he says there's nobody stupider than the Americans. He says Roosevelt's conference was what he said. His press conference was typically Hebraic, meaning he's reading from a Jewish script that's handed to him. And he says the Americans, the further they fall, the greater their disillusionment. He hit the nail on the head right there. And he says Churchill and Roosevelt, what imposters.
Yeah, well, of course, he hated both of them, and he saw through them and all their phony hypocrisy. But then again, he said that they're going to, he said something about the further they fall, something wasn't a humiliation for them. I don't know what he was talking about, because now we're in January 42. They weren't doing so badly, or were they? I mean,
they were. They were getting rocked back on their heels in the Pacific. The Japanese were
sweeping
through the Philippines.
He's on the Japanese here, right?
Yeah, and you know, and he knew the Americans were quite haughty and proud, and here they were getting beaten everywhere they were and getting overtaken.
Right.
And he said now they thought they were invincible to the little yellow bunch of race from Japan that, boy, they can't stand up to our soldiers, and here were the Japanese kicking butt. And so, yes, there had to be, the further they fall, the greater their disillusionment, and that's what he was referring to.
Oh, yeah, those Japanese were tough.
Yeah, exactly.
That day, boy, were they tough, those guys. Mm-hmm. And this whole section, he was really, he's thinking about the Far East is what he's thinking about most in what he's
right.
saying, except when he started talking about the Spaniards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was okay. analyzing the allies of the Germans on the Eastern Front, and you know, when he says the Hungarians are good auxiliaries and with proper siphoning, we find them useful. Romania has only one man, Antonescu. But then, like you said, very properly so, the very, very complimentary comments about the Spaniards, who were also in their Waffen SS division fighting on the Eastern Front. And they might be undisciplined. They might be as goofy as they come.
Yeah, and they had bad leadership. I mean, in the sense of that they were so class conscious in Spain, you know, that the officers got everything and the men got nothing.
Yeah.
But Hitler always disapproved of that kind of thing.
Exactly, exactly. Being a veteran himself on the bottom rung, and here he says, but you know what? The Spaniards never yielded an inch of ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what Hitler loved.
Yes.
He loved anybody who didn't yield, and that's what he held against some of the others.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, we want to move on to 5th of January, 1941, midday. Special guests, Dr. Tot, Sepp Dietrich, General Gauss, and Colonel Zeitzler. The situation of the English on the military level is compromised in two sectors of vital importance. One of their greatest bases is Iran, Iraq, and Syria. That's where their fleet takes on supplies. The other is the Malay archipelago, where they are losing all their refueling points for oil. They can trumpet abroad their intentions concerning Europe, but they know very well that it's the possession of India on which the existence of their empire depends. If I were in their place, meaning the English, I'd say, it will be impossible to reconquer India once it's lost. My chief care would be to put everything I had on the road there, even if it were only one division. I have a clear impression that they're ransacking their cupboards to try to save their positions in the Far East. Projects are one thing, but it's the event that calls the tune. It would be conceivable that the English should have Indian units moved to Europe, but these are mere movements for movement's sake, such as reduce an army's effectiveness. They'd lose in the one quarter without gaining in the other. If things go on following this rhythm, in 4 weeks, the Japanese will be in Singapore. It would be a terribly hard blow, and the space there is so vast that there could be no question of holding it with a division. I'm going to stop right there for one reason, where he says, if things keep going the way they are, in 4 weeks, the Japanese will be in Singapore. Now, he's doing this on January 5th, and he was only off by a little bit over 1 week because Singapore fell February 15th.
Mm-hmm.
So he was exactly right in what he was viewing. Okay, now he says the situation would be entirely different if the English had a few thousand tons of fuel in reserve. Some time ago, when we were transporting material from Sicily to Tripolitania, the English evaded battle in an incomprehensible fashion. Yet for them, it's a matter of life or death to prevent us from supplying our troops in Africa. If our today's convoy succeeds in getting through, that will be a poor lookout for them. If I were faced with the alternatives of losing either Tripoli or India, I'd not hesitate to give up Tripoli and concentrate my efforts on India. General Gauza declared, "It was a relief for us to learn of Japan's entry into the war." The Fuhrer says, "Yes, a relief, an immense relief. but it was also a turning point in history. It means the loss of a whole continent, and one must regret it, for it's the white race which is the loser.
Now that's interesting. I have to say right here. Again, he's saying the white race. I think this is the second time.
Yes.
Now, I brought up sometime recently that he had said something. Now, I don't remember now what it was.
Yes.
And then somebody wrote or said to me somewhere that, you don't know by the translation whether they said, I know, we were talking about how last week that he said Nazi. And
yes,
you brought that up. And then somebody says, that doesn't mean this is some kind of Jew translation and so on and blah, blah. And they're sticking those words in there. And it doesn't mean he really said that. Well, we don't know if he said Nazi, but somebody, it was translated as Nazi. And I don't think, since it doesn't happen very often in here, hardly ever, I don't think these translators are deciding to do that. I don't think they're Jew translators anyway, and I don't know why they would suddenly put in that word unless it was some kind of a slangy word. But that's the kind of thing people will say. So I think of that when I bring up, he's mentioning the white race, then people will say, it's translated and you don't know what he really said. So.
Well, that's an excellent point, Carolyn, because it brings up what we talked about the first day when our program was to discuss this book, mm-hmm. and about the skepticism among so many people that it's authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying, it was a lot of Bormann's ideas and everything. Well, one could picture Bormann saying something like, it's the white race which is the loser. Maybe he did inject his feelings occasionally in these messages. But
why would you picture Bormann saying that? See, I wouldn't think that at all.
Huh.
Bormann would necessarily say that.
Yeah. Well, it was just my impression of Bormann was an extreme nationalist who would be more likely to say something.
Yeah, extreme German nationalist.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But much more likely to say something like that than the pragmatist Hitler, because of wanting to keep things more centralized on the Germans and.
Well, see, I don't totally have a different impression of that. I think
interesting.
I think it's very likely that Hitler would say that. As he's talking about it, and particularly we're dealing with the East and with the Japanese and the Indians and so on,
mm-hmm.
and he's distinguishing. And somewhere else, I think he does it too.
Mm-hmm.
The white race, meaning he's talking about, the West, versus the East,
the yellow race.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. I agree. I think
it's interesting that he says that. I'm not trying to make him into a white nationalist or a white racist at all, because that's not really what I'd want to do. But
exactly.
But just the fact that he recognizes and can use that kind of language,
sure,
without any problem. But as I said, some people will argue about everything like this.
Oh, yeah, they nitpick about things like that and overlook the most vital thing.
Yeah, but I think I've got my little note here saying that he's not an Asianophile,
mm-hmm.
But he respects them. He respects
yes.
them, but he's not one of them. And somewhere he said, if it's in tonight's material, maybe that we could never get along with the Japanese. I mean, we could never share living space with them, sort of like, because we're too
different.
But he's a European through and through. Although I don't
sure.
want to make him into a European nationalist, like some people want to. But he's a Westerner. He's that's
yes,
the same thing with the Islam. People want to say, he really loved Islam and the Arabs and would have joined with them and so on. Never. He wouldn't have.
No.
So.
But he would have appreciated them as an ally.
Oh, yeah.
Against a common enemy.
Oh, yeah, and he would have treated them fairly and he would
yes.
have been respectful. He was all those things.
That's right.
Yeah. But he still wanted, basically, he thought the Germans, it had to be a German culture. Germanic culture is what he thought was the best.
Yeah,
correct.
After the the start of the war in September of 1939, the Germans made such advances so quickly and pushed the British troops back to Dunkirk and in essence, shocked the world with what they had done. And then shortly following that was a period called the Phony War. It was a number of months where there was no fighting. They were just kind of looking at each other across the English Channel. And it was in this period then that the British started trying to huff and puff. And I think that's what he means in this next paragraph when he starts off by saying, in 1940, the English told us that the flying fortresses would pulverize Germany. Of course, the flying fortresses were the big bombers that they had in their arsenal. They told the Japanese that Tokyo would be razed to the ground within 9 hours. On the basis of these boastings, we were entitled to suppose that during 1941, they would multiply their efforts in the field of air warfare. To cope with this possibility, I had our flak reinforced, and above all, I had enormous reserves of ammunition built up. In actual fact, during 1941, we used only one quarter of the ammunition used the previous year. I believe that if we can get through to Rommel enough petrol tanks and anti-tank guns, the English will have to dig in on the defensive, and we shall again have the chance of getting them on the run. Just about now, Rommel should be receiving 200 tanks. I'll never believe that an American soldier can fight like a hero. And it's ironic that that one sentence ends this little section. And it's kind of off the wall after talking about Rommel and supplying him. And,
yeah.
And then he comes right out.
He probably just was thinking about it, and then he said it. And so the guy thought that was important and wrote it down.
Yeah.
And left out a lot of other stuff.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it was an isolated statement that I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's a theme that I can see him just coming out with having that thought often enough. He's really against the Americans.
Oh, yeah.
And yet he thought the United States was a great country. And he thought it, well, he thought as a country, he thought it was a wonderful piece of land.
Oh, yeah.
And amazing and all, but he thought that the Americans, well, he probably means more like the government and the people.
Yes, yes.
He just had no respect at all. Well, you know, but here he's talking about... what the English promised to do to Germany. Well, they did eventually do that.
Sure.
He's feeling pretty good about it here and saying, and it's probably a good thing he had his flak reinforced and all his ammunition reserves built up. I hope he kept it there because he was going to need it from 42 and on. But they had these wonderful flak towers that he did have built. Of course, some of those were built after the bombing got worse, but
right.
In the big cities. But they're amazing structures. I love reading about them. I just think they were, you know, you could be inside there and be so safe. And then they had all the big guns up on the top.
Right.
So they did a lot of damage to those planes that were coming over to bomb them. But as time went on, they were not able to do as much damage to them.
Right.
You know, more and more. But so sometimes it's almost not so good, you know, to know what happened.
Yep.
When you're reading this, because you're thinking, well, you know, he's saying this now, but he's going to have to eat his words. I don't like to think that, you know, but he doesn't have to eat his words. But you know, things did change.
Well, that's a natural inclination to think in terms of hindsight. You know, but you got to put yourself back there in the moment.
That's right.
And his view and vision was limited to what was going on right then, and here we are, you know, 70 years later or whatever, so we can say doggone it. But
well, it's good that you point out these things that where he was absolutely right about things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's good. Keep doing that.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's go on. The night of the 5th and 6th of January, 1942, special guest, Sepp Dietrich. Stalin pretends to have been the herald of the Bolshevik Revolution. In actual fact, he identifies himself with the Russia of the Tsars, and he has merely resurrected the tradition of Pan-Slavism. For him, Bolshevism is only a means, a disguise designed to trick the Germanic and Latin peoples. If we hadn't seized power in 1933, the wave of the Huns would have broken over our heads. All Europe would have been affected, for Germany would have been powerless to stop it. Nobody suspected it, but we were on the verge of catastrophe.
Yeah, just think if the Weimar Republic just kept going.
Yes.
How weak it was.
Oh, absolutely. And there was communist activity all over Germany at that time.
Oh, yeah. That's
by
right.
Rosa Luxemburg, the Spartacist movement.
Well, although they had communist... I was talking about Richard Sorge on Monday, and they, you know, he was involved in lots of stuff in Germany in the 30s.
Right.
Actually, in the 20s. Wait a minute. I got that wrong.
20s,
in the
20s. Yeah.
You know, where they were trying to take over as much as they could. But the mood of the German people wasn't for it. They really didn't go for it. So it wasn't being that successful. But they would have kept trying and kept working on it. And they were never going to give up. They still haven't given up.
No. One of the interesting sentences in that little paragraph right there, to me, if we hadn't seized power in 1933, the wave of the Huns would have broken over our heads. And, of course, Hitler's referring to the Bolsheviks, the Mongols.
Asiatic Russia.
Yeah, the Asiatic hordes.
Yeah.
And it's ironic that American propaganda was labeling the Germans as the Huns. At that time, then even General Patton used that same phrase.
Yeah, well, in World War I, they called them.
British, the same way.
The British started that.
Yeah, and of course, what that was designed to do, when you call somebody a Hun, the number one thing there, that means they're a non-Christian, they're a non-believer, they're pagans.
Yeah.
And when you take away any godliness or whatever, then you really demonize the enemy, and that was just part of the arsenal of hate cooked up by those trying to keep the war going and to heat it up.
The propaganda. You know, the propaganda side of war is just as important as the battle side. It really is, and it might be the most effective.
Yeah.
And that includes then the spy systems and the intelligence networks and all of that stuff is hugely important, and we're not supposed to know too much about it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, then he closes that. Let me close that paragraph again. Nobody suspected it, but we were on the verge of catastrophe. He's talking about 1933. To what an extent people failed to suspect it, I have some evidence. A few days before our entry into Russia, I told Goring that we were facing the severest test in our existence. Goring fell off his perch, for he'd been regarding the campaign in Russia as another mere formality. What confirmed me in my decision to attack without delay was the information brought by a German mission lately returned from Russia that a single Russian factory was producing by itself more tanks than all our factories together. I felt that this was the ultimate limit. Even so, if someone had told me that the Russians had 10,000 tanks, I'd have answered, "You're completely mad."
You know, if he's saying that a few days before June 22nd, mm-hmm. 1941, he at that point was told that a single factory was producing all those tanks. That makes sense, because he's not going to, he wouldn't have changed his mind anyway. But people make a lot of the fact that he had that conversation with the Finnish president or general or whoever, I can't think of his name now, later, and he said, I had no idea that the Russians had the capacity and had all those tanks and planes and everything that they were producing way in the east in those factories. And if I had known, I don't know if I could have gone through with this or something like that. He said, they've got that recorded. Something like that, he said. I don't think there's any way he would have not gone through with it. It was just a manner of speaking. that he was doing it. Here he says, and this is in 1942, that he learned about at least one of these factories and all that they were coming up with. That's amazing. All of the German factories together, this one Russian factory, must have been a huge place, huh?
Right.
Out there, hidden away. He just went on with it. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say at that time, too, the Russians were receiving tons and tons of American goods. And actually, before that, before we jumped into the war, we were shipping to them over the Bering Straits all kinds of military equipment. And this figure that he used here, he says, even if someone had told me that the Russians had 10,000 tanks, I'd have answered, you're completely mad. But I saw years back a statistical list of the advantages that the Russians had over the Germans in armaments at the time that they locked horns, and everybody has always been pushed to believing that the German war machine outnumbered the Russians in tanks and all this stuff. And you know, the stat that I saw on that list was the number of tanks that the Germans had available was between 3,500 and 4,000 in Operation Barbarossa. And what did the Russians have to oppose it? 10,000 tanks. Mm-hmm. And so Hitler says, you know, if somebody had told me they had 10,000 tanks, I'd have said, you're completely mad, but they did have those. And so...
Yeah, at this point, I guess he knew it.
Yes, yeah, by this time, yeah.
Yeah.
And,
but then he figured that the German superiority in battle would compensate for a lot of that.
Yes.
And it did.
It did.
And, of course, the thing of surprise, he always said that the most important thing was the element of surprise in a battle. But they lost that over and over again because of the treason.
Exactly. That is correct.
But then now, you know, he's talking. You were mentioning how they got all this, all these tanks and planes and so on from the United States. Maybe they got parts. Maybe they got some of it.
That's true.
And maybe they got plans for how to build them. Because he goes on now to talk about how they can't invent anything, but they're good at copying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what the United States was shipping them before December 7th. Was tons of food, fuel, and the munitions that they could ship, and that, you know, and that's so phony about this supposed Americans have been taught to about the fight between capitalism and communism and how opposed they were to each other, and here you have the biggest capitalist nation on the face of the earth trying to keep the biggest communist nation on the face of the earth alive. By providing them with everything they could to defeat National Socialism.
Yep.
Okay, then Hitler says, as you pointed out, the Russians never invent anything. All they have, they've got from others. Everything comes to them from abroad, the engineers, the machine tools. Give them the most highly perfected bombing sites. They're capable of copying them, but not of inventing them. With them, working technique is simplified to the uttermost. Their rudimentary labor force compels them to split up the work into a series of gestures that are easy to perform and, of course, require no effort of thought. They eat up an incredible number of tractors, for they're incapable of performing the slightest repair. Even the Czechs, who are the most efficient of the Slavs, have no gift for invention, and yet they're hard-working and careful. When Skoda was started, it was by Austrians and Germans. I looked up that Skoda, Carolyn, and it was auto manufacturing, which I was kind of unaware of, but Czechoslovakian auto manufacturing, it was started up by Austrians and Germans.
Makes sense, and you know, the thing about... Again, he really knows what he's talking about all the time. I would agree with him that the Czechs are the most efficient of the Slavs, at least You know, yeah, well, I guess thinking about the Slavs, they are. When I was over there, and the little time I spent in the Czech Republic, which was only like maybe less than 2 days, part of it was traveling, I was impressed by the Czechs, much more than with the Poles. Mm-hmm. And their country and the way it looked more like Germany. Everything looked more like in Germany. But again, they don't have what the Germans have. They are lacking in some of that brilliance, and they certainly aren't known to, of course, they're a smaller number of people, but they're not known for having a lot of great men, art in the arts and mm-hmm. Science and so on. But they are industrious people. They are. So I think what he's saying is just right there.
Yeah.
And they were willing to cooperate too. They really were not so much against the Germans. They just thought they had to be because they wanted to be, you know, everybody wanted to be
independent
or something.
Yeah,
but
that's right.
But they got along well, and the people actually during the German occupation, or the what wasn't even an occupation, it was something called something else. They were pretty okay with it, and that's why the British. I don't want to get off the track here, but that's why the British instigated that assassination of Heydrich, because mm-hmm. the Czechs were getting along just fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Destroy their factories, and the Russians can't rebuild them and set them working again. They can barely manage to set a factory working that works all by itself. Although they've always bought licenses for the most modern aircraft, their RATA, R-A-T-A, is a flop. Their most recent models are still far from catching up with our 107. The Japanese are capable of improving something that exists already by borrowing from left and right whatever makes it go better. At the time of the pact, the Russians displayed a wish to possess a specification of each of our ships. We couldn't do otherwise than to hand over to them inventions, some of which represented for us 20 years of research. These peoples were always inferior to us on the cultural level. Compare the civilization of the Greeks with what Japan or China was at that same period. It's like comparing the music of Beethoven with the screeching of a cat. In the sphere of chemistry, for example, it's been proved that everything comes to them from us. But the Japanese are at least discreet. They keep to themselves the secrets that are entrusted to them. Our two navies have always worked in a pleasant spirit of collaboration. We owe precious information to the Japanese. What was painful to me was to endure the visit of the Russian commercial delegation. The Russians probably learnt the secret of the rockets by some piece of treachery committed before we took power. In fact, they've remained at the stage of technique of the period and haven't profited by the progress we've made since. Nevertheless, they've adopted a guiding rail, which perhaps they got from the French. On our side, nobody in the Army knew we had the rocket. The Russians attached importance to the fact that the rocket goes off without making a noise. Our heavy rockets make such a hellish din that nobody can endure it. It has a psychological effect in addition to the material effect. There's no point in hiding the discharge of the shot from the enemy, for in any case, there's no means of protecting oneself against it. I didn't realize that the ricochet firing had such a destructive effect. Keitel has always favored that technique. A shell from one of our field guns, which weighs only 16 kilos, produces on the enemy the effect of a heavy shell. In the technique of armament, we shall always be superior to the others, but we ought to preserve the lesson of history and take care after the war not to allow the others to penetrate our secrets. No new invention will be permitted to be published without a special authorization issued by an office set up for this purpose, even as regards countries in which we're linked by agreements.
Well, boy, now that's the end of that section, and I have to say, when I read that, it was just really, really made an impact on me that Hitler is saying we need to preserve, we ought to preserve the and take care, the lesson of history, and take care not to allow the others to penetrate our secrets. Mm-hmm. And, of course, one of the saddest things is how the Americans especially, but all of them came in and stole everything that the Germans had come up with and took it home with them and, you know, worked on it more and made it theirs. They even took German men. I've always been sorry. As famous and as von Braun was in America and supposedly what a good, what's that called? Now I can't think of the word. What a good ambassador of goodwill he was for Germany or whatever. I'm sorry he ever went there. I admire the female pilot, Hannah Reich, for not ever going along with the Americans and never being willing to go over there like they wanted her to do with all the others and staying loyal to National Socialism. And she suffered for it, she saw it through. She has so much inner strength, that woman. I'm really sorry about all those ones who did go. They thought, they were told, and they fell for that thing that they had to fight the communists. And now the Russian Bolsheviks, you know, their big fight was always against Bolshevism, and they had to fight, you know, now the United States had to be the one that stood up to that. Ha! After all they did, you know, and... So that supposedly was a reason. I think that was pretty transparent, and I don't know why I would like to have seen all the Germans just refuse to go along, refuse to cooperate whatsoever. But that didn't happen. It never happens.
Right.
But, you know, I'm just irritated to this day. I was really happy to see that Hitler said that, and he would never have. If he had anything to say about it, you know, he would have said, no way. And he would have tried to prevent it. Because he knew not to trust these people. And then they what have they done with it? Gone on to take over the world themselves.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, well, my little rant there.
Well, that's a very good point, though. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to the 6th of January, 1942, midday. I've realized one thing, the worst of Freemasonry is not so much the philosophic side as the fact that it's an immense enterprise of corruption. It's a handful of men who are responsible for the war.
That's an important statement, right?
It is, indeed. Mm-hmm. Churchill's predestined opponent was Lloyd George. Unfortunately, he's 20 years too old. The critical moment was when Chamberlain and Deladier returned from Munich. Both of them should have seen very clearly that the first thing to do was to dissolve their parliaments. If Deladier had organized an election, the fire eaters would have been routed. The whole people would have approved of the peace policy. But it was only a respite, and the agitators were not slow to raise their heads again. England and France are engaged in losing what in our eyes is only a fictitious wealth, that is to say, gold and foreign holdings. Their true wealth, which nobody can take away from them, is their human potential, but on condition that it's used in such a way as to exploit the country's natural resources. This war will have helped to originate one of the world's great upheavals. It will have consequences that we did not seek, for example, the dismemberment of the British Empire. Who are the guilty parties? The Jews. What happens to England is totally indifferent to them. A Horbelisha, who grew up in the ghetto, couldn't have the same reflexes as an Englishman. Experience teaches us that after every catastrophe, a scapegoat is found. In England, it will probably be the Jew. But let them settle that between themselves. It's not our mission to settle the Jewish question in other people's countries.
Well, now, what do you think about that?
That's a powerful, powerful statement that flies in the face of everything everybody's taught. Back at the first of this little section here, Churchill's predestined opponent was Lloyd George. And then he talks about 1937 when Chamberlain and Daladier returned from Munich, were, you know, peace in our time or whatever, 38. And your war propagandists make the most of that by calling Chamberlain an appeaser, giving in to Nazis' demand and stuff like this. And they were out to scuttle any chance of peace at that time. But Hitler said if Daladier and Chamberlain had gone back and dissolved those parliaments.
Called for new elections.
Yeah. And the fire eaters, meaning those agitating for war, would have been routed, and the whole people would have approved of the peace policy. And he's exactly right. I know that's true, especially in reference to England, because I've done a lot of research back then, on the era back then about the English people. And the little guy, the common folk, wanted no part of another European war. Mm-hmm. And they did not share the ambitions of those in Parliament that wanted a war with Germany, saying balance of power policy and we got to knock these Germans out and things like this. The little guy did not want any part of that. So he was exactly right when he said the whole people would have approved of a peace policy, which was his offering at Munich.
Mm-hmm.
So,
he says that, he again doesn't forget to see that the guilty party is the Jews. And he says that the British are going to lose their empire. He was right. They did. And so this did not help the little guy in England, because then they said, well, now all these our former colonial states, they can come to Britain, they can come to the United Kingdom, and they're citizens and so on and blah, blah. So then Britain is invaded by all these people, and that certainly is harming the average person. And he says, who's behind this? The Jews. And then he brings up this horrible Elisha, and I looked him up, and I read all about him, and he was the son of Jacob Isaac Belisha and Elizabeth Miriam Myers, two Jews. But his father died before he was even a year old. And then his mother married a man named Sir Charles F. Adair, or H-O-R-E. And he became that was his stepfather then. And through that, he got into government. He got well-educated and so on. And he eventually became transport minister and later war secretary during the first part of the war. And he didn't grow up in a ghetto, although Hitler says here he grew up in a ghetto, but he didn't grow up in a ghetto. Maybe he would have, but if this man hadn't married his mother. And I just have to ask myself, why did this Englishman marry a Jewish widow with an infant son? What could he have possibly gained from such a thing? Strange. But he did, and that's how these things go. I'm not saying that it was some kind of a conspiracy, but, he just chose to do that for whatever the heck reason, stupidly, and that's how these things happen.
Right.
So.
Right, and Carolyn, that very last sentence in that section, it's not our mission to settle the Jewish question in other people's countries. Well, why that struck me as so pertinent was because of this Holocaust stuff that's been pushed at us for 50, 60 years. What that says is exactly the opposite. They said Germany was trying to settle every nation's Jewish question by shipping them to the extermination camps, and that includes out of Hungary, Czechoslovakia, anywhere they could gather up the Jews. That would be settling the Jewish question for these other countries, and that's what they want the people to believe, In actuality, this sentence right here, it is not our mission to settle the Jewish question in other people's countries. And to me, that means let them settle their own issues.
Yeah, but
with
you know
Jews.
What I thought, too, also from that, Ray, is that what we've learned is that, of course, you can't control the rest of the world, but if you don't get the Jews, if you only get the Jews out of your own country, they've still got a place in all these others, and they're still going to come back after you.
Mm-hmm.
So you're still under threatened by them. Although that was the best that they could do, you know, they say, well, we need, and they got them out of all their occupied territory. That's
right.
What they meant by their own countries, and try
sure.
to put them into other countries.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's not necessarily going to solve the problems, even that. And that, look how hard that is, how impossible almost that is to do.
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's just...
You know, to me, the obvious goal of National Socialism was to rid Europe of that, for lack of a better word, mm-hmm. pestilence, and make it an independent economic unity.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Okay, January 6th, 1942, in the evening, guest General Dedel. In peacetime.
Oh, there's that great Dedel again. I described him a while back on another program. He's a real favorite of mine. Anyway, go ahead.
In peacetime, it's necessary to govern in a spirit of economy. For that, there's one condition, which is that order should prevail. Another condition, for that matter, is that cleanliness should prevail. In every organization, the art consists in finding a formula in which the necessary strictness of the rule is tempered by the generosity called for by the facts. We shall never completely eliminate from the administrative services the spirit of pedantry that paralyzes all initiative. In important cases, we must arrange for a third authority to intervene, equipped with the necessary power of decision. It's really moving to observe what is happening just now about the collection of wool for the Russian front. Civilians deprive themselves of their most precious possessions, but they must have the conviction that everything is being put through without the slightest fraud, and that every object will reach its proper destination. Let anyone beware, therefore, who might try to interfere with the proper channels and intercept, for example, such and such a sumptuous fur, which will be worn, perhaps, by the simplest of our soldiers. Now, that's a very brief little section right there, but it really affected me in a positive way.
Me too. Me too, Ray.
I thought I just put in the margin there, good stuff, spoken like a true man of the people. And what he's talking about is on the Eastern Front, this is the time when that winter is so bad and the suffering. And for many German units, they had not received their shipment of winter clothing.
And, you know, that's something, we don't have time to talk about it now, and I don't really know anything for sure. But when I first came upon that, you know, I just thought, well, that was a real screw up, you know. But there was another time when I came across Hermann Giesler asking General Jodl about that, who was on Hitler's general staff. And Jodl told Giesler, there's a lot I could say about that, but it's better I don't. And, you know, something or other. I think that was some kind of sabotage. I don't think that was, you know, somewhere where the... Because it was also said that they put their orders in plenty of time for this winter clothing, and then nobody could understand what happened to it and so on. Why it didn't get there, they didn't have any explanations for it. But I don't think that the Germans screwed up on that. I think it was had to have been something else, but I've never found any answers to it.
Right, me either, but I think that speculation about it being treason within that caused this. But, you know, it's... The folks back home were getting letters from Hans, you know, at the front, how they were freezing to death and they don't have their winter clothing, whatever, and the civilian population reacted immediately to bundle up everything they had. And like Hitler says here, some of the their most precious possessions, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and get them shipped to the mm-hmm. Russian front so that those fellas over there right. could at least try to stay warm.
And right, what and then he says, you know, anybody who interferes with this, that's a serious, you know, yeah. That's terrible for mm-hmm. anybody to try to profit for themselves by yeah. taking any of this stuff. That these citizens, yeah. he's always talking about how the civilians deprived themselves, and they did. They sacrificed yeah. a lot at
that's
home
right.
for the troops.
That's right.
They're always being called upon to do so.
Right.
It's very moving if you're mm-hmm. pro-German.
Yeah, I agree with that, because it certainly was for me. Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll move on to the night of the 6th and 7th of January, 1942. The changing of the guard at Rome is not good news, I think. In my view, too frequent changes of leading figures are a mistake. A responsible chief who knows that he probably won't have time to complete a job that he'd like to embark on, generally sticks to routine. I don't understand why one should create such situations. In that way, one merely aggravates one's own troubles. The reason why I can carry the new responsibilities I am undertaking is that gradually I've been freed from certain responsibilities by colleagues to whom I've given the chance to reveal themselves and who've succeeded in deserving my trust. It's possible that the Duce can't find amongst his advisors the sort of collaboration he needs. For my part, I've had the luck to do so.
Well, I'm going to break in here and just real quick say that I looked, Ray, to find out what happened in Rome at that time, that there was a changing of the guard, and I couldn't find a thing. Now, this is January 42, and, you know, it just it has to have been kind of going on at this time. But something, I don't know. I couldn't find anything.
Mm-hmm.
I found a lot of interesting stuff, I'll say that, and was reading away on it. But I don't know if you have any idea what he's referring to.
No. You know, I knew there was a little instability going on in Italy. There was a
sure.
faction that said, hey, let's get out of this war or let's switch sides. They were the
yeah.
switch side, or
yeah.
people were much fewer in number, but this let's get out of this because we can see the writing on the wall now that
that's right.
we're allied with someone who's fighting the United States, England, and Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, and things aren't looking good. We better skedaddle. And so there was instability there, and a shakeup in the government apparently is what has happened.
Yeah. Something that Mussolini had to do. He wouldn't have wanted to, but he was under pressure, I think.
Right.
I think that's what Hitler's probably referring to.
Okay, going on, he says, if Brauchitsch had remained...
Brauchitsch,
yeah, had remained at his post, even if only for another few weeks, the matter would have ended in catastrophe. He's no soldier. He's but a poor thing and a man of straw. Later on, people's eyes will be opened to what these 4 weeks were for me. And I looked up that Brauchitsch.
It's a chess sound, Brauchitsched.
Brauchitsched.
I worked on how to pronounce that word.
Yeah.
Brauchitsched.
Anyway, he was a German field marshal who was the commander-in-chief of the German army early in World War II and listed as being dismissed by Adolf Hitler in 1941 for his failure in the Moscow offensive.
Mm-hmm.
That's who he's talking about there.
Yeah, he disagreed with Hitler, and Hitler didn't want to give up on Moscow, and all these generals did. And go ahead. I interrupted you.
No. That's all right. You know, he was just one of those that Hitler felt was incompetent up to the charge given to him. And he said,
well, yeah, and there was a lot of controversy about that. But that's when Hitler, I'm sure it was, when Hitler made himself commander-in-chief at that point, because he didn't replace
yeah.
Brauchitsch with anybody He then became commander-in-chief because he felt he couldn't get his generals to do what he wanted them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's been criticized for that.
Yeah.
But again, in hindsight, you can always say, well, Hitler made this and that mistake, and if he hadn't replaced his generals, that wouldn't have happened. They would have done better. Well, they didn't always do better at all. But Brauchitsch was a real nobleman, you know, from a real old noble family and a long time in the military service and so on. And he personally disliked Nazism from the beginning,
right?
But yet he did his job all right. I mean, he tried to do his job, and he wasn't one of those who were trying to overthrow Hitler. He didn't go along with that. Of course, he was out of the picture already in 1941. So the end of 1941, and put him in the reserves, but Hitler never did assign him anywhere after that. And he seemed to have a lot against him, too. He talks about him kind of a mean way, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yet he thought he suffered a lot from it. He thought it was very difficult for him himself. He says, later on, people will see what these 4 weeks were for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that, I don't know if anybody saw what they were. I don't know what... I didn't get too much information, couldn't find too much about how it actually looks after that. But.
Right. 7th January, 1942.
Yeah, and so there's a timeline real quick.
Okay.
January 7th, 1942, heavy air attacks on Malta. Remember we were asking about
it. Oh, yeah.
And Malta was an Allied base. See, I wasn't sure what side they were on. That's how bad I am. It was an Allied base, and so they did a lot of bombing, both the Germans and the Italians, on that island. It says here, if you can believe Wikipedia timeline, that it's estimated that the bomb tonnage dropped on the island is twice that dropped on London. Well, there wasn't that much dropped on London. Just on London? How much was dropped on London? Because it was all over. You know, but I guess the Blitz is supposed to have been mainly in London. Oh, well, that's what it says. So it's I think before we read some, it said that there was the most heavily attacked area in the war or something like that, air attacks in one little place. So.
Yeah.
That was on the 7th.
Right. 7th of January, 1942, evening. I never met an Englishman who didn't speak of Churchill with disapproval. Never one who didn't say he was off his head. Supposing we had lost the war right at the beginning, there would nevertheless be a hegemony on the continent, the hegemony of Bolshevism, and that's what the English would have been fighting for. The fact that America is insisting on England's abandoning the Far East will obviously never bring about any change in Churchill's attitude towards America. The man is bought. One thing may seem improbable, but in my view, it's not impossible, that England may quit the war. As a matter of fact, if today every nation were to reckon up its own private balance, England would today still be the best off. Now, if there's one nation that has nothing to gain from this war and may even lose everything by it, that's England. When the English have abandoned Singapore, I don't quite see how they can face Japan with any chance of success. Thanks to her bases, Japan dominates the sea as well as the air. The only possible hope for the English is that the Russians should help them out from Vladivostok. If the English knew they could get out of it all simply with a black eye, I believe they wouldn't hesitate for a moment. India, being only a land power, she ceases to have any interest for them on the strategic level as soon as Singapore has fallen. Men like Eden are no longer fighting for their pockets, but solely in the hope of saving their skins. Besides, all the guilty men are still there except Horbilicia. If it turns out badly, their compatriots will have bones to pick with them. The English were generous as long as it was only a question of distributing other people's property. Today, they're not just fighting for new profits, but to try and save their empire. Hitherto, they've been able to accept things philosophically, to say that Europe was not their direct concern, that the conquered countries were not theirs. But after the fall of Singapore, everything will be different. Where, in fact, is the frontier between East and West to be laid down? Will England be in a position to hold India? That will depend on the maintenance of sea communications, since there are no communications by land. Churchill is a bounder of a journalist. The opposition to Churchill is in the process of gaining strength in England. His long absence has brought it on him. If a nation were to quit the war before the end of the war, I seriously think it might be England. I don't definitely say so, but it seems to me possible. England and America have now decided to produce synthetic rubber. It's not just a matter of building factories. They also need coal. The problem will become really acute for them in the next 6 months. At this moment, all states have similar difficulties to overcome and are living from one day to the next. But it's certain that for England, her present difficulties have incalculable implications. One safeguard for the future is that the Japanese should never give up the preponderance they are obtaining in the Pacific. The important question for England will be whether she can hold India. It might be possible to negotiate a separate peace which would leave India to England. In that case, what would happen to the United States? They would be territorially intact, but one day England will be obliged to make approaches to the continent, and it will be a German-British army that will chase the Americans from Iceland. I don't see much future for the Americans. In my view, it's a decayed country. And they have their racial problem and the problem of social inequalities. Those were what caused the downfall of Rome, and yet Rome was a solid edifice that stood for something. Moreover, the Romans were inspired by great ideas. Nothing of the sort in England today. As for the Americans, that kind of thing is non-existent. That's why, in spite of everything, I like an Englishman 1,000 times better than an American. It goes without saying that we have no affinities with the Japanese. They're too foreign to us by their way of living, by their culture. But my feelings against Americanism are feelings of hatred and deep repugnance. I feel myself more akin to any European country, no matter which. Everything is about the behavior of American society. Everything about the behavior of American society reveals that it's half Judaized and the other half Negrified. How can one expect a state like that to hold together? A state where 80% of the revenue is drained away for the public purse. A country where everything is built on the dollar. From this point of view, I consider the British state very much superior. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. You go ahead and discuss that.
Well, when he says, I never met an Englishman who didn't speak of Churchill with disapproval, I think he's correct there, particularly about the little guy. And then he says it's Bolshevism that the English would have been fighting for. But particularly when he says...
Fighting for, not fighting against.
Yes, that's right. And the fact that America is insisting on England's abandoning the Far East will never bring about any change in Churchill's attitude towards America because the man is bought. That's an important statement, and he's right on the money with it. But, you know, one would think that a guy like Churchill would stop at nothing to preserve and protect Britain's empire. But here he is with the Americans suggesting, oh, go ahead and back out of the Far East. That was very self-promoting for the USA to have that market whenever the war was over or whatever, to kick the British influence and marketing out of there for themselves. And he says Churchill was bought because he didn't protest against that at all and rise to the defense of the British Empire.
He had become so dependent on the Americans.
Oh, yeah.
He just
let himself,
you know, he had to have the Americans come into the war, and then he was just agreeing to anything and everything. Mm. He never seemed to recover from his downfall in that. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, and then the important part here where he goes into discussing about if there's one nation, and it may seem improbable, but if there's one country that will quit this war, it would be England. And, you know, he says, I don't have any proof of that, but my gut feeling is that the Brits, if they had a chance, would back out of this war. And as I was telling you earlier, Carolyn, that brought back a lot of memories for me when Tyler Kent was a guest in my home back, oh, my goodness, in the 1980s, 30 years ago. And I was discussing with him, and of course he was the decoding agent in the American Embassy working for Joe Kennedy before the war started for the United States, and he was decoding messages between Roosevelt and Churchill, and the messages in themselves were a breach of protocol, if not legality, because Churchill at that time was the equivalent of Secretary of the Navy, and Roosevelt here was dealing under the table with Churchill rather than with the Prime Minister of England, and assuring Churchill, I'm doing everything I can to get us in this war, you know, and Churchill, he's squealing like a pig under a gate, hey, you know, the Germans are kicking our butts everywhere, you know, we're going to have to back out of this, we're going to have to draw an accord with the Germans if something doesn't change in a hurry. So rush, 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 get us out of here. And that's the kind of thing that Tyler Kent was decoding and finding out what was really going on. And so Hitler was exactly right when he says that if there's one country that's about or that could back out of this war, it would be England. And that was certainly within a whisker of happening had they not goaded the Japanese into bombing Pearl and getting the USA into that thing. So, once again, Hitler's analysis, and he says, I don't know if I'm right or not, but if I had to say that England would get out of this war if they could, he was exactly right.
Mm-hmm. But then Tyler Kent's plans on what to do with his information didn't come about because his whole little group there that he was working
yes.
with.
Yes.
And that's what happens when you have associates who know about what you're doing. Maybe he would have been better off had he functioned just all on his own.
Yeah, that's true. You have a leak in the system and an informer.
Yeah, it was actually a traitor in the system.
Yeah, and, you know, and Kent's plans were to keep those decoded messages that he was making the copies he should make, but he also made an extra copy to put in his own files in his little flat there in London, and his goal was to gather enough of them to hang Roosevelt by bringing them to the United States, presenting them to Congress with the help of the America First Committee, Charles Lindbergh and a handful of others who were doing their best to keep us out of that European war at the time. And Kent hoped that by exposing these messages between Roosevelt and Churchill, that this war fever could be totally cooled and people here would come to their senses and say, look what our president's doing to us.
Yeah, and now in this case, the United States was not at war yet.
That's right.
So he was not being a traitor during wartime.
That's right.
Yeah.
He actually committed no crime except or breach of laws except that he made extra, an extra copy for himself.
Yeah, he has.
I had no idea how many copies he made, Carolyn. I always had in my mind that he must have copied maybe a dozen significant documents or something like that. And I asked him, I said, Mr. Kent, do you know about how many copies of messages that you made during that number of months that you were compiling all these before you were arrested? And he said, yeah, approximately 1,500.
Wow.
And so, so he had the goods that could have changed history for the better.
Mm-hmm.
And kept us from jumping in on that war, got rid of Roosevelt, exposed Churchill for what he was doing. And it's just such a crying shame that that he got derailed.
Yep, and there was somebody in there. I don't know. Well, we don't have time to talk in detail about that, but you can say where you wrote that whole story out.
Mm-hmm.
If people want to go to it. But it's not online anywhere, is it?
No, was.
You know, you should send it to me. I could put it on my website.
The Barnes Review article?
Yeah, I could put it on my website as a permanent, in a permanent
okay,
place.
Okay.
That would be good.
But at any rate, we're pretty close to running out of time here.
Go a few minutes over.
Okay. But I was going to say this is not a real bad place to kind of dog it off before we hit that next long section about Hitler's school days, instances hilarious.
It is.
Very, very humorous. But
if you have anything more you want to say about this section before we say goodbye, because, we'll have to save that, Hitler's reminiscences. And, boy, it's long. He talks a lot about it. And we'll have to do that next week. I thought we'd get that done tonight, but
mm-hmm.
I guess it's too much chatting.
Well, that's all right. I think it's been a positive. And my final comments here about Hitler's last remarks about the America being a decayed country and then drawing a parallel with the downfall of Rome, these kind of racial problems, the problem of social inequalities were what caused Rome to fall. And yet Rome was a solid edifice compared to the United States. And mm-hmm. and he says, I like an Englishman 1,000 times better than American. I can't blame him one bit. And he says, my feelings against Americanism are feelings of hatred and deep repugnance. And I know the reason for that is because America, to him, was the six-pointed star and strictly the dollar sign. And no substance, no spirituality, and that's how he saw American society, as being totally Judaized, or as he said, Negrified, half and half.
Yeah, and when you see him saying, I don't see any future for America, and my first thought is, well, hell, America took over everything after the war and was running the world, and yet, look at today,
yes.
They're still pretending to do, but he was right.
His
he
long
was
range
right.
View,
it was, he saw it already, that it
exactly,
was decayed.
Yeah.
It couldn't make it, and it makes me, reading this today makes me feel even less confident. I don't have confidence anyway. I think, I wonder how soon the end is for the United States.
Right. Right. Yeah. He was right on the money.
Well, he was. Well, Ray, we're ending right on the hour and a half mark here, so I think we'll just do a perfect job of it. And I think you did a great job tonight. I think it was a good program.
Thank you.
And so we'll say good night to our listeners and tell you to return again next week for where we're going to be talking about reading about Hitler's reminiscences. So good night for now.